Welcome to the award-winning Love Joy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. You know what? I love these guys for continuing to support this podcast. They're great people with a great product. They also support my other work too. Go to Lovejoy HQ on Twitter or Instagram to find out more about the magazine and the online show. Both are doing amazingly well, so thank you for that. Thank you for reading and watching and listening. The Cooker Tap is a great bit of kit. If you can afford one, you will not be disappointed. Go to cooker.co.uk to look at the different models. Today, I'm curious about what's going wrong in society. just a small topic here we're going to cover. I've got a feeling this is going to be a bit bleak, but hopefully important. Hopefully might make you look at things a bit differently. I'm hoping to learn something today. And see what I think. I try and be upbeat and positive, but I don't know about you, but I'm trying not to watch the news too much at the moment because we've got ourselves in a bit of a mess, I feel, and I feel the news is not helping it because it's making me feel very negative. So I'm spending a lot of time not letting that enter into my brain, into my world. But hopefully we can look for some solutions on this podcast and feel more buoyant about the future, happier about what's happening. Joining me is Robert Vercek, who's written a book called Why You Won't Get Rich and Why You Deserve Better Than This, where he explains what he thinks is wrong and how we can fix it. You might remember Robert wrote the book Posh Boys, about how the elite in Britain run the country and keep passing the power down onto their children. That's the general gist of the book. I recommend you read it. If you haven't read it, you can listen to the podcast I did with him a while ago. It's very good, interesting stuff as well. Gets you really thinking about how Britain's run and the society we've created for ourselves. Anyway, let's meet him. Here's Robert. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to speak to you.
Great to speak to you. I suppose we might as well just get on with it. I mean, since you've written the book, things seem to have got worse, which is, he's showing me the cover, Why You Won't Get Rich and Why You Deserve Better Than This. But, you know, it seems to me that we're in a bit of a mess at the moment in this country. When you wrote the book, did you envisage it was going to get worse than it was when you wrote it?
No, because I wrote the book just before we went into lockdown, and I thought that was pretty bad. So, you know, I laid out the economic landscape sort of post the last financial crisis, 2008, the credit crunch. And then as I was writing it, pandemic struck. So there were all sorts of other economic and human challenges. You know, we were, as you know, we were facing terrible problems that we didn't think we'd, extract ourselves from for, you know, many years. And then we came out of the pandemic and we walked straight into a war with Ukraine, Russia, an energy crisis, and then these sort of self-inflicted political injuries caused by the current government. So no, I did not envisage this.
All right, before we get stuck into all the detail, I think a brief description of what your book is would be a good idea, because as we say, the title Why You Won't Get Rich and Why You Deserve Better Than This is a big title, isn't it? Because I think we all assume at some stage in our life we have the potential to go and earn a load of cash and buy ourselves a yacht. You're pointing out in this book is pretty unlikely, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is a big title, and it's a huge sort of take on what I consider to be a problem with capitalism. And it's sort of, I started to realize this when I was working for Citizen Advice Bureau, which is an independent charity that looks after problems that absolutely anyone might face in their lives. And while I was volunteering for them, I kept seeing people who, you know, through no fault of their own, were not just impoverished, but facing, you know, daily challenges that they didn't, you know, it's impossible to recover from. And, you know, it wasn't just, it wasn't just a typical families who were living on universal credit or, you know, were struggling on, gig economy jobs or zero-hour contracts. It was nurses and policemen who I was seeing were coming into the office and saying, look, I'm really struggling. You know, the police officer was particularly concerned that, you know, he had to give up his flat because he couldn't, on the wages he was on, he couldn't afford to keep his flat going, pay for his kids. So he'd returned to his parents. And nurses coming in saying that they were so hungry, you know, could we have a food bank voucher, please? So it seemed to me that this can't be right. You know, in a modern economy, it can't be right that the first responders and police officers, nurses, teachers, ambulance drivers, firemen, people who we rely on to get us out of emergency situations. These are the people who are finding it hardest to survive. So I started looking at the big problem. Why isn't capitalism delivering? And what happened to this idea that if you work hard and dream big, you will be fairly rewarded? Wasn't happening.
Yeah, you've got some solutions, which we'll go into later. One of the bits you say in your book is we're the fifth largest economy based on GDP, but wealth is spread so unevenly among the population that we are only the 29th richest country in the world per capita. Because I assumed this separation between the rich and poor, the rich getting richer, I assumed it was happening in every country, and that was just a side effect, if you call it, of capitalism. But is it unique to maybe us in America and a few others, or is it happening in most countries?
No, that's true. Modern developed economies, that certainly in America, and parts of Europe, that is true. The rich are getting richer. Their assets, since the credit crunch 2008, their assets, generally speaking, certainly in this country, have doubled. So, you know, the houses, their investments, their yachts, all these things that you associate with extraordinary wealth have doubled in value. But, you know, there are other economies which are much flatter, where the difference between the poorest and the richest is much closer. So Scandinavian countries, it's like Denmark, less so Sweden, but and certainly Norway and Finland. These countries have much flatter economies. So what happens is they tend to pay more tax, and they accept that they will have to pay more tax. But they also know that the communities in which they live are much fairer, and the difference between what their neighbours earn and what they earn and what they own is nothing like the kind of differences you see in America and Britain. And it seems to me that these are happier communities, happier economies, because there is less avarice, less greed, less jealousy, there's plenty of social surveys to point that up as well.
Yeah, I spent quite a lot of time in Scandinavia. And one of the things about Scandinavia is the populations are a lot smaller than this one, than ours. So it might be a bit easier to make things feel nicer over there. The other thing about Scandinavia is they do spend a lot of, my Norwegian friend comes over here and he says, the problem with your taxes is you can't see where the money's going. Whereas in Scandinavia, everywhere you go, it's new. And they keep rebuilding stuff and make it look new. But the problem over here is when you do that, people will go, why are you spending money on building a new whatever it is, train, bus system, tube system, bridge, when you could be spending money on the NHS or the poor? We've got this real problem with where our money as taxpayers is being spent. And just by the way, I think paying tax is a very important thing, and I think it's important to pay into society. I think people who skip tax are, I don't think that's a nice thing to do. And I believe you pay in and you look. I think it's great. We've got the NHS and we've got support for people out of work and everything. So I believe it's a good thing. The other problem you have in this country is people don't trust the government where they're spending their taxes. I'm sure we're going to get into inheritance tax later on, and I'm sure the argument there will always be, I've earned all this, you know, spent all my life earning money to give it to a government who are just going to spend it poorly. And this, we don't have any faith. Whereas in Scandinavia, they sort of have a bit more faith their governments are going to spend it wisely. Is that not the case?
I think that's dead right. I really think that is so important, because what they do, certainly in Denmark, I looked at Denmark and Finland close, what they take a big tax, contribution from everyone, but as you say, there's confidence that they're going to spend it wisely. But when we talk about spending it wisely, we're talking about long-term investment, and I think rather than this all this short-term sort of quick result investment, so that they'll put money into the water. Let's take the water companies, for example. Invest in the water companies for the long term. So if there's a problem with aging sewage system, then they'll make sure that they've got a long-term plan to sort it out. Whereas in this country, our sewage system is creaking, but because the companies have been privatized, it's all about rewarding the shareholders with dividends and profits for the shareholders, but and salaries for the directors and the CEOs. And you know, it's more about what can we extract from the company in terms of profit, rather than what can we use the profits for the long term investment in a creaking sewage system, so that we stop polluting our rivers, or you know, we lose billions of pounds worth of water through leakage. That problem hasn't been addressed. And because of this sort of short-term investment policy, it's all coming back to bite us.
I suppose those state-owned industries years ago, they weren't really working, were they? I mean, sort of, you know, it took you 6 months to get someone to come around and fix your phone, or the trains were never running and breaking down and things. And I suppose that was the argument of why they privatized a lot of the industries and tried to make them better and more efficient. Isn't that the case?
Certainly, yeah. I remember British Rail, you know, if you wanted a sandwich, you were going to get something very soggy and very little cheese in it. The trains, by and large, they did run on time. I mean, the rolling stock was getting old, and the idea was that we need to update the rolling stock and, you know, improve the punctuality. But there was also a sort of unionized resistance to any change, which clearly meant it was politically, you know, politically appealing to try and do something about our state-owned companies. But we seem to have gone the other way now. We seem to have gone from that, where there was a problem, but the way to fix it was and the only way to fix it was considered privatizing. And we seem to have gone the other way, where we privatized everything and not bothered about dealing with the very thing that needed to be tackled, which was long-term investment of the utilities and the transport systems. And privatization clearly hasn't worked for so many of them.
Isn't it our fault, though, as the electorate? Isn't it our fault? Aren't we the ones who just moan and whinge constantly and put the politicians under the pressure that they're trying to do short-termism constantly to keep themselves in power and make themselves look good? If anyone ever suggests anything long-term, yeah, even though, I mean, I don't want to get involved in the argument with the high-speed rail up and down the country, but as soon as someone suggests that, the whole, you know, half the people go, well, that's a good idea, and the other half the people say, no, spend the money on the poor and the NHS. So you, it's for, and look how much over budget it's gone. The Elizabeth line, look how much over budget. It's this constant, you can't win as a politician, so you might as well just do short-termism.
I mean, but that's their job. I mean, you know, they're supposed to be able to take these risks and look towards what's best for the people of this country in the long term, not sort of what's going to be most politically advantageous in terms of getting them back into power within the election cycle. I think that's their job. But when it comes to, but the problem is, so much is now privatized that politicians have little influence over where these companies invest their money and what decisions they make in terms of long-term priorities. Their hands are tied. They leave it up to the, you know, the directors and the shareholders to make those decisions. And these aren't the best decisions for our utilities.
But how do we get to a situation where politicians can make long-term decisions, though? Because, yeah, I read Tony Blair's book once when, you know, because he was obviously one of our most popular prime ministers when he came into power. And one of the first things he said is, once you're in power, you've got these great ideas, but not only the opposition, even if they think they're a good idea, is telling everyone, the electorate, that they're a bad idea because they want the power back. But also your own party, there's infighting in your own party who are, you know, especially in the Labour Party, which is sort of split middle of the road and left wing, they're now having a go at you as well. So it's very, very hard. Politics is so childish in it's, you know, you could not run a company like we run the country with this constant power struggle. You know, can you imagine trying to run Amazon or one of those big companies with this constant power struggle? So is capitalism bad, or is it the people running our government and capitalism the problem?
Yes, good question. I mean, if you change capitalism, are you going to get the same results because you've got the same political system? I don't think that's true. I think that if we do rejig capitalism and make it fairer, make you know, introduce progressive taxation and redistribute some of the wealth and reprioritize our utilities, politicians would have to follow on. They'd have to, you know, impose the will of the people. I guess because it's a 5-year parliamentary cycle, it's, you know, within about 2 years, politicians are starting to look towards the next elections and wondering about their own political futures. So it is tricky. It is tricky. If you fix capitalism, you know, within 10 years, you might find that politicians have done away with all those progressive changes that you've introduced.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that Adam Curtis documentary. Can't remember which one now, because I've watched a lot of his. Where he sort of states in it somewhere along the line that Tony Blair, during his power, realised that the government had less power than the city, and he was subservient to the city. And I sort of look upon that as thinking that was kind of important power shift in our country, where I suppose Thatcher still was the most powerful person in her era. Now the city hold the power. The government, if they are subservient to them, that means the sort of people you're attracting into the city are not necessarily caring about the welfare of the nurses and firemen and policemen and teachers and things you were discussing there. They care about profits because that's the nature of their job. Do you think there's any truth in that? That's the way we've gone?
I think that's true in terms of the power that the city holds over decisions made by the by our politicians. I mean, the government found out very quickly this week what happens if you go against the markets. I mean, that mini budget from last week was, yeah, an absolute disaster in terms of, and it shows you what happens when a government thinks they are all powerful and can take on the city. It's going to very quickly unravel, and has done, and is still unraveling. We don't know where it's going to end. So I think that's a good point. The tension between the markets, the city, and government is ongoing, and ultimately there's always going to be one winner. If it's a head to head, it's always going to be the city will win. And so what was the other point?
I was just saying, is it the sort of people who are running capitalism which is the problem, than actual capitalism, that we've created a world where, say, it is the city who and their job is to make money. You know, you don't employ someone in the city. You know, if you've got your pension with the city, you don't go. Oh, well, most people don't sit around. Most people don't understand how it works, including me. But we don't. Most of us don't sit around going, oh, where are you investing every penny in this? What they're going is, how much money are you making me? That's kind of the idea of your pension, to get them to invest it. So that's with that being their objective, they're hardly going to be going, let's care about let's value the nurses here. Let's care about that. They care about making money.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, we had that fantastic opportunity, didn't we, in the middle of the pandemic, when we were standing outside our houses every Thursday applauding the nurses, the, you know, the supermarket shelf stackers, you know, all the key workers. And I thought that was a moment. I thought, this is the time when we really are going to start valuing the people who make a difference to our everyday lives. Because it seems to me that the more vital your role is in society, the more, you know, in terms of emergency, the people we turn to, these are the people who are paid the less. These are the people who count for so little. And some people don't get paid anything at all. There are carers, hundreds of thousands of carers up and down the country, looking after relatives, providing a vital role, or get paid absolutely nothing and are not acknowledged in the tax system. But what happened after the pandemic? You know, absolutely sod all, nothing.
Well, The rail strikes are happening at the moment, and other unions are coming out striking. And what I'm finding really interesting about this is, as soon as they're striking, the rail strikes are happening, the media immediately are on the side of the companies against the strikers. You are not letting people get to work, is the message. But we're not going, hold on, these are the people. By the way, it wasn't the train drivers to begin with who were always, they earned 60 grand. And Boris Johnson even came out and said that. And they weren't even on strike. It was the lowly paid people in the railways that were going, look, we put our lives at risk, basically, without, you know, through the whole pandemic, and we paid nothing. And I on my WhatsApp groups with my friends, I started looking, and it's very easy for us all to take the sort of thing from years ago, smash the unions, hate the unions. But I was going to some of my friends who were so unaware of this. A, our prices of tickets have gone up. B, no British company owns one of these railways. We sold it all off to French and Dutch and I can't remember who else. So they're not actually. So it's not like it's taxpayers' money here. We've got to pay these. These people have got profits, and they're just not paying British staff the money to work on the railways. Yet we don't want them to go on strike. So the first time it's really come up after the pandemic, we've all forgotten about the clapping. Haven't we? And we've gone, I want to get to work. And that's basically what's happened. So I'm saying constantly, is it our fault? Actually, maybe the media's fault as well, because they sit the union bosses on there and they have a go at them, rather than going, actually, we agree with you. Why aren't we paying the lowly workers more money? Why can't they have a bloody living wage? I don't get it. Why aren't we forcing this upon these companies?
It is strange, isn't it? And it perhaps incredibly predictable. But wasn't there a bit of Wasn't there a bit of a sort of backlash for some of the media when they started interviewing some of these union bosses? Because what happened was, it turned out that we weren't all opposed to the strikes. Lots of people were turning up during the strikes and actually supporting striking railway workers. And, you know, this certainly some of the media were finding out that the railway workers were actually doing a very good job, and they could, I think we were beginning, weren't we not beginning to see, look, it's first they come for the railway workers, and next they'll be coming for you. You know, because inflation is so raging now that we're all going to need a pay rise at some point. So railway workers have gone first, but you know, nurses, teachers are also taking industrial action. And I just think there's a sense that everyone's going to need a pay rise to keep up with inflation.
Was there a time years ago, I know there was, because you mentioned it in your book, that we valued these jobs more and that people had more more spending power with their pound? There was a time, wasn't there, years ago where it was better. It's got a lot worse recently. Is that correct?
Well, certainly in terms of gap between the rich and the poor, that has increased from the 19s. In the 1970s, we were a much fairer society. With a salary, you had an average salary had a good chance of owning your own home, and the very rich were people who you could see what they owned, and you could perhaps imagine yourself one day also owning or living that kind of lifestyle. In the 1970s, we were of a much more equal society. But since the 70s, and I looked at this in my book in terms of football matches, because something my father-in-law said, he went to the 1970 FA Cup final between Arsenal and Liverpool. And he paid £1 for his ticket. And he's always telling me this. So I started looking at that. I started looking at what would it, if you put £1 into the Bank of England inflation calculator, what would you end up with now? What could you expect to pay now? Because I wanted to take my kids to an FA Cup final, but couldn't afford it. So that £1, if you put that £1 into the inflation calculator, it comes out about 15 quid, which is what you should be paying for an FA Cup final ticket. But in the reality is, of course, you know, the cheapest tickets I could find were about £45, and they went up to about 115. And the same was true of a pint of beer. You know, if we were paying prices of the 1970s, you can expect a pint of beer to cost £3.50. So you should be paying £15 for your football ticket and £3.50 for your pint of beer. And clearly that is not happening. And it seems to me that what we've got just simply does not go anything like as far as it used to. And you know, for me and you, going to football matches, you know, might not be the end of the world, but for the younger generation, the millennials and the Generation Z, I mean, they're being denied whole life chances. They're being denied, they've given up of owning homes. You know, they've given up on regular holidays. They've given up on so much. And that seems to be much more serious indictment of what's happened in the last 50 odd years.
I think football's a great metaphor, actually, for where society is. As a Chelsea fan, it costs an absolute fortune to go and watch Chelsea now. And, you know, we were mentioning the people we should value in in the world. I'm not sure they can in society their jobs. I'm not sure they can afford to go to Chelsea. And success is in our minds is all about winning. And I think we've created this environment where it's become quite vulgar, actually. You know, Chelsea, we're not winning, so let's spend £300 million on more players so we can win, and we're still not going to win because Man City have just bought one player who's better than all the rest of us anyway. And they've got a great manager and they're looking good. We're down the road here because, you know, I live in West London, so Chelsea, my team. But down the road, we've got Brentford. And Brentford are doing really reasonable price tickets. They're a very family club, very community orientated. They're not seen as successful yet. If you look at them, I think the successful one is the ones who hasn't spent a lot of money. They're giving great value for their fans. The atmosphere there is amazing, and they've also got something. They've got the highs and the lows to support. Where as a Chelsea fan, we got sucked into the sort of what I like to call the Man United and Liverpool way of looking at it. If you're not winning, it's a terrible thing. Whereas, you know, with Brentford fans and Fulham fans and QPR fans, all the other fans around here, they are all looking at, can we just get a result this week? And, you know, what am I getting value for my money when I go to the football games and things like that? Whereas you're definitely not getting your value for your money at Chelsea. You are watching the best players in the world, but yeah, it's costing so much money now to go up there. And I think, I suppose it's a good metaphor for how maybe we've all just got really greedy and we just don't mind the rich companies getting richer and richer and richer. And people like Amazon and Starbucks and people like that, we're letting them not pay tax for some god. I just don't know why they're just not paying tax. And we're also allowing it. And the government seemed too scared to go, we need to tax these people. If they want to come over here, we need to be taxing them. We need to find a way of taxing them. Is that true?
I think, yes. I think there isn't. We've been, ordinary fans have been priced out of football games. And the kind of economics is sort of fantasy economics, isn't it? The transfer fees beyond anything we can really comprehend. But then the government seem to deal in these kind of figures as well. They don't seem to mind how much money they borrow, provided, you know, they're doing what they want to do. So, you know, whether it's going to war in, suddenly, you know, they tell us that they can't afford to, they couldn't, remember they took that 20 quid off the universal credit after the pandemic and given everyone on universal credit, a £20 uplift, and then straight afterwards, that was removed. And they said they couldn't afford it. But then, you know, they tell us also. They tell us that they can afford, but they can afford to abolish the top rate of tax. That's not a problem, because, you know, that's only going to cost £2 billion. I think money doesn't seem to matter. They borrow whatever they want to do whatever they want to do, and the figures, they never seem to add up. To the point now where our GDP is actually, I think it's about 3 trillion, which is actually equal to our national debt, which is the first time that's ever happened. And you know who's going to pay for that? Of course, it's not going to be you and me. It's going to be our children and our children's children. We're just kicking the can, debt burden can, down the road for somebody else to pay for.
Yeah, I think we have to remember as well, the government don't have any money. So when Rishi is doing these wonderful things like Eat Out to Help Out and stuff during the pandemic, it's your money that they're doing it with. When they say we're going to give Ukraine 100 million, it's your money. I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't, by the way, and they shouldn't do any of these things, but it is our money they're doing it with. It's our taxpayers' money. It's not like they've got this drawer full of cash and they're being really, really, really wonderful. You know, it always makes me laugh. It's like, you know, it's like Boris and Rishi and all those guys and Liz Truss now, they have a market store and they've been earning all this cash and they're gonna let you have 100 million of it. It's your cash they're just messing about with, which is a problem. I always feel so sorry when you like you're a policeman, a firefighter, nurse or whatever, and you hear that the government goes, we're going to support Ukraine, here's another 100 million. Imagine what it's like for them to hear that they're going, oh, I can't feed my kids, and we're now going to spend 100 million pounds in a place that I've never been to. Now these things are important because we don't want Russia to gain massive power, obviously. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it must be a hard thing to hear that. Oh, by the way, we're going to we're going to give bankers their bonuses back. I mean, how tone deaf is that? Even if it's a great idea to get the tax back on the bonuses, it's so stupid because the last thing these people want to see is bankers get more bloody money. It's mental the way they think.
It's like they've sort of run out of sensible ideas, and this government has come to the end of it. Of its life expectancy, because as you say, it is completely mad, some of these decisions. They really think that, not just tone deaf, but it's sort of economically stupid as well. It just doesn't make sense. Why would you take away 2 billion tax take from the richest earners in this country? Why would you do that? What advantage? Because these are, I mean, I was speaking to people after that, people in big law firms who, you know, partners who were earning, you know, up to £1 million a year. And they just immediately thought, my God, this is extraordinary. This is, you know, when they said they weren't going to tackle, they were going to lift the cap on bonuses. And then they discovered that they were going to abolish the top rate tax. I mean, it was like party time in the city. But why? I mean, the people in the city couldn't understand it. They thought it was as mad and stupid as everybody else did. The only people who seemed to think it was a good idea was the current cabinet, and maybe not all of them, as it turns out.
Why do you think we're in this position then? Why have we got the wrong sort of politicians? I know you wrote a book called Posh Boys, and I understand that the cabinet is now made, I think it's, isn't it, 2/3 or something of private educated people again. Liz Truss has gone down that road. But are we getting the wrong people? Are these people just not in touch with what's actually happening out there? Is this the problem?
I think it's worth asking the question, isn't it? Because we've had now, we've had two Etonian prime ministers and one Etonian chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, who, you know, seems to be held responsible for this latest economic catastrophe. That's one school, isn't it? That's one school that has shaped the government of this country since 2010. And, you know, disproportionately, those governments have cabinets where the majority of the members of this cabinet have come from particular institutions, private schools, whose families have had to pay £100,000 to school them. So I think, and my book Posh Boys is all about how the disconnect between these politicians who've been sent to palaces in the country and then end up running the country is perhaps not the best form of government. I mean, for one main reason, that is you are depriving this country of a huge pool of talent. You know, that it's very shallow. Very shallow pool of individuals who we are choosing from to run this country. If we're just choosing from, or mostly from, the 7% of people who went to private school, and we are largely ignoring 93% who didn't, because, you know, as the system works, and you know as well as I do, if you go to a private school and you've spent three times as much money on your education than a state school kid, you have a disproportionately much better chance of landing top job, not just in the city, but in parliament as well, in the civil service. And so, you know, end up by being run by people who've been to institutions that most of us know absolutely nothing about and have no experience.
I suppose the argument is people will say, well, they're the best then, because they've had that education. They'll be the best people to run this country. Do you agree with that?
No.
I know you don't agree with that because I've read your books.
You don't agree with that. And, you know, you only have to consider what's happened in the last 2 weeks to understand how wrong that idea is. I mean, if they really are the best people for the job, and they've shown just how, you know, misconceived that idea is, because it's been an absolute, you know, cock up. And it takes an Etonian mentality to believe you can take on the markets and win. I mean, that is arrogance beyond even Boris Johnson.
I think the bit in your book that resonated with me most was Vince Cable, who I don't believe went to a private school, who ended up in the coalition government in Cameron's time with Nick Clegg. And it was the comments he makes about it. He could not believe what he was watching play out. And I think that was the thing, which, because we can all get a bit bitter and twisted. I had a state education. I think I'd have rather had a private education and a livery and all those sort of things that they have, butler, whatever Boris had, and all that money and wealth. I think I'd have quite liked that, and the contacts coming out of it. You know, I don't begrudge them it really. I don't believe we should have a segregated education system. I think we should all go to the same schools, including same sex. I don't think there should be those or faith or grammar. I think everyone should go to the local school. It should be an important part of the community. I'm a big firm believer in that. However, I don't want to be bitter and twisted about them. But yeah, it's when Vince Cable sort of highlighted that he could not believe what was playing out in politics, when he's an old politician, he's been knocking around for ages, when he actually saw what was happening, that was the bit which sort of was a bit of an eye opener for me.
Yeah, close quarters. What did Vincent Cable call it? The cabinet was like a public schoolboy pillow fight in a dormitory. That's how he described it. He was.
Yeah, and he said Brexit was similar, wasn't he? He said they were just playing out old school rivalries and things as they were playing out. We thought it was the general public all doing it, but it was literally sort of old public schoolboys having a little play with Britain.
Yeah, you can narrate the story of Brexit by just naming people who went to a select number of private schools. You know, whether it's Daniel Hannan, Nigel Farage, Cameron, who called the referendum, Johnson, who switched sides and, you know, was instrumental in the winning of the referendum, really. Right through to government of today. You know, very easy to describe events in this country which have taken place without any reference to a state educated person. But I take your point about not being bitter and twisted and chippy, I believe is the word they like to use when you sort of have a go at private schoolboys. But I don't have a go at private schoolboys. I have a go at the system, the idea that we have a sort of apartheid education system in this country, which deprives the nation of so much genuine talent and consigns so many children who live in poverty to end up dying in poverty without ever knowing there are charitable institutions like Eton and Harrow, whose sole purpose is to improve the life chances of already extraordinarily privileged children. So it's a system, not the individuals, because the individuals who benefit from this this system of premium advantage and lifestyle are usually entertaining, interesting, you know, great company. I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them are. I mean, they're it's not their fault that they ended up at an institution which propelled them to such heights in our society.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the contacts and connections you get when you go there is, I think it was pointed out in your book, isn't it? Eton, you get I think it's Eton where you ask, did you go to school? And if they, is that, it was near your book?
That's,
and if you
right,
say,
yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So, if you say yes, it means you went to Eton.
So that's for, yeah, so recognition. They seek each other out. Obviously, you would, you know, you've been to a special school where you're taught to be special, you seek each other out in the workplace or at university. And one of the questions that Etonians use to establish whether or not they're talking to one of their own, they ask the question, did you go to school? I mean, because for them, there is only one school, Eton. You either went to Eton or you didn't. But if you and I were asked that question, you know, did you go to school? We'd go, yeah, of course we went to school. Yeah, didn't everyone? What are you talking about?
Well, I suppose we all have it, though, connections in their own way. If ever I want a photocopier, my friend Tony can sort me out and he can always do me a good deal. Because he's doing quite well for himself at the moment. As they've moved on from photocopies, he's gone into all sorts of mobile equipment these days. Okay, let's look at the solutions to this then. First one is obviously taxation. We've got a problem with taxation because the money's all going one way and it's not going down to where we need to get it from. So we've got to look at various ways of taxing. One of the big ones that you talk about is the inheritance tax. Now, as I was looking at this today, flicking through the news, Andrew Griffiths, the Treasury Minister, has said that he's going to potentially get rid of inheritance tax totally. He's going to abolish it, which I actually think is bizarre, is going to be very popular, even amongst people who aren't Tory voters, because of that thing that I said before. People have built up any form of wealth, whether it be £10,000 or £10 million, hate giving it to the government. They'd rather pass it to their family. So that, I think, is going to be a popular thing in the country, even though what people don't realize is you'd be taking money from extremely wealthy people and tens of millions of pounds and channeling it back into the economy. But you think it's a good idea to actually increase inheritance tax, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is extraordinary. I mean, that's part of the current cabinet playbook, isn't it? This idea that we remove all taxes. I had no idea they had inheritance tax on their radar. I mean, because all the argument is for increasing inheritance tax, because it's the one thing that would change the transfer of extreme wealth from one generation to the next. You impose a proper inheritance tax, because at the moment it's like an inheritocracy. We just simply, or the richest families simply, pass on all their wealth to the next generation without any sort of charge against it. Because what is it? I think it's about £320,000 in it before inheritance tax kicks in. So and anything after that,
how much is it? Did you say?
I think it's about £320,000, which is, you know, reasonable, but I think we need to whack up the amount, not the point when it kicks in. We need to start talking about, you know, 50% inheritance tax, where the wealth that has been accumulated, you know, for hundreds of years through generations of families through the transfer of untaxed assets needs to be properly held to account and returned to the communities. And then we're going to, that will be a serious challenge to the very great gaps between those who have absolutely nothing and those who have everything.
Isn't it just a case, though, where if you do that, you know, I know some of our politicians and some of our leading members in society, all they do is store their cash abroad, and all you're going to do is encourage them to do more of that. It's good tax planning, isn't it? They're just going to stick everything abroad or put it all in, whatever they need to do to get around it. People, the average person can't afford to do that and won't do that. And yet the guys with the cash will just, they'll find a way, don't you think? There's a loophole.
Yeah, no, I mean it will present lots of challenges, and you're right that there are, you know, lots of ways in which they can dodge it. But do you remember when I think it was the Labour government, Blair's Labour government, who said they were going to impose tougher taxes on the yeah, the 45, the 50 pound, the 50 pence tax for the richest earners in this country. They were going to impose that. And the big response, immediate response was everyone is, all the rich are going to leg it. They're all going to go abroad, and you know the bankers, the top the celebrities who've earned an awful lot of wealth, we're all going to go abroad and leave the country. But you know they never did. I remember there was a series of them. You know, Rod Stewart was one of them who said, "Yeah, I'm going. If you start squeezing us, then I'm just going to leave the country. I'm never going to come back. I'm going to be a tax exile." But they never did. They didn't actually do that. They stayed because it wasn't. It turns out it wasn't as harsh a tax as they thought it was going to be. In fact, they even knew it was going to be. They just resist any attempt to curb their wealth. So I think the same would be true.
Being someone on TV and having a tiny bit of celebrity gives you the keys to the world. You get to meet all sorts of people. And I was, a load of different people. And I'm sitting at having a meal once and I'm sitting listening to this bloke. And it just amused me so much. I'm not going to say who, but they were going, "Oh, bloody hell, I've got to leave the country again next week." And they're going, "Why? Why?" And goes, "Oh, if I still have to pay tax, so I've got to go. And I just don't want to leave, but I've got to leave the country for X number of whatever, blah, blah, blah. Otherwise, I've stayed here too long," and da, 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 da. And I thought, "Oh my God, you got more money than bloody God, and you can't live where you want to live. How mental are you? Just pay your sodding taxes and live in the country you want to bloody live in." And I just thought, I just wanted to point out, you are insane. You're sacrificing your life so you don't have to pay bloody taxes, you idiot. Anyway, you know, each to their own. There's many of those conversations doing the round, I'm sure. I try and keep these but an hour, and there's another couple of things I want to go on to. So, the universal wage is the one that I'm most keen on hearing about, because it's been on the horizon for quite a long time. Countries, as it says in your book, countries like Finland, I think, and Netherlands are having a look at it. Even in Scotland, I think we're having a look at this, aren't we? People don't understand the universal wage because they don't understand people getting money for free. I think you better just explain how it works and actually that it does work, I think.
Yeah, it is a radical idea. It's a universal basic income. And what happens is that instead of our sort of dependency benefit system, you replace that with a free wage. And you know, obviously, there are lots of discussions and arguments about at what level do you set it at. But what happens is you give everybody a free wage up to a certain limit, even if you're working. And so,
can I just say the amount in your book was £26,000 somewhere?
Was part of a Channel 5 experiment.
Right. Okay. So that's not necessarily what it is. Okay. All right.
No, but that's why not 26,000. That does seem a lot, I have to say. But so what everyone thought would happen is that, oh dear, all you're doing is you're giving a load of lazy people who have no interest in work a lot of money, and you're just going to finance a dependency culture, a very different one and perhaps a worse one than the current benefit system. But all the exercises projects which have looked at it have shown that the reverse happens. Well, people actually been given some money that they can use to support their lives, real money, not sort of universal credit money or benefits money, which just keeps them ticking over from one hand out to the next. What happened was that people started to think about what to do with this money. They wanted to protect it. They all want, because everybody wants to improve their position in life. But so many people don't have the chance to ever do that. But if you give them a reasonable wage, which does much more than just allows them to simply get by on a day-to-day basis, people were investing this money. It was setting up businesses. They were finding jobs and saving money, so they had something, you know, they could actually protect. People became very motivated and were making contributions to society. And what happened was, so all the volunteers in places like Finland and Canada, people who provide voluntary services, as I said before, looking after a relative, or, you know, volunteering a food bank or whatever, doing something in the community. Suddenly, all these people who had opted out of we don't count them in the economy. They don't have any value in our economy. Are suddenly being given value and being rewarded for their part in the society. And I mean, the best thing about it was that not only were people not squandering the money that was given to them, we got rid of the benefit system, which costs, you know, billions of pounds a year to manage. You know, the administration of the benefit system costs an absolute fortune. So overnight, that's gone, and you've got a new motivated society whose happiness and personal wealth has improved overnight.
But the argument is that I'm having to pay tax to give to this money to these people, and people go, well, why should I pay for someone not to work? You know, and that will always be the argument with this, won't it?
I think absolutely. I think, you know, people will say, you know, why should I pay for someone not to work? Why should I pay for these liggers? But the point is, we're already paying anyway. We're already paying so much of our contribution to our taxes goes towards the benefit system. All you're doing is you're refocusing it. And, you know, a lot of these people in these experimental projects ended up coming off the universal basic wage because they've gone on to, you know, they use the money for further education, for training. They've gone on to take jobs where they were getting paid more than the universal basic income. So, you know, as again, it's back to the idea about sort of long-term investment in our citizens. And, you know, if you treat them fairly and invest in their lives, it's amazing what ultimately you're going to get out of that.
I think my biggest problem I've discovered on doing this interview with you now is when we talk about Finland, which I know very progressive, and we talked about Scandinavia, and we talk about countries like that. I keep coming back to the fact that I don't trust our government with our taxes, and that is a real fundamental problem. I'm not sure whether I'm wrong here, but I at the moment don't. So I don't trust, if the government had to give us all lunch every day, I don't trust them to be able to produce lunch for the whole population, even if we gave them more than enough money. Whereas I trust capitalism to sort of achieve that. So I worry about giving any money to the government, and especially after, during the coronavirus, that whole term with Boris Johnson in charge, the amount of mistruths, lies, whatever you want to call it, the amount of, you know, the scandal of the PPE going to their mates and people who run pubs and stuff, that's our money. And there is no consequences for anyone. And even when they get sacked, they're still coming, walking their way back into public life. TV producers are trying to put them on reality shows. And, you know, it's like, hold on a second. Why are these people not answerable to their actions with our money? If I took your money, Robert, and went and blew it somewhere for spurious reasons when I said that I was going to do something else with it, there'd be comeuppance. You'd find a way to sue me or do something. There's nothing we can do about it. And I think that is my fundamental problem at the moment, is no consequences for any actions from the government. Big sigh there.
Yes. Because it's you're asking about our political system. You're saying, you know, does democracy deliver fairness, justice, and responsibility? Because, you know, we're lucky to live in a liberal democracy where we each have a free vote and we elect our, you know, it's first, maybe it's the system of democracy there. Maybe because first past the post delivers some very binary outcomes. It's either the blue or the red party who's going to win. Perhaps we need to look towards a proportional representation system government where, you know, more voices are involved in the government of this country. And people, and with proportional representation, at least you're going to feel like your vote really does count. And we're going to get perhaps people with a wider interest in issues that a lot more people feel have real value in our society and need to be represented. We need to have their, they need to have their say as well, because at the moment it seems to, you know, violently swing from one kind of government to another. And as you say, people's trust in that system seems to have been eroded.
I think with my problem with the government is at the moment, and I really try not to talk about politics, but I'm going to, and I'm going to regret this. It just seems very childish to me. It doesn't seem like, I mean, PMQs, I always argue with politicians and political commentators who go, it's brilliant holding the government to account. No, you're not. You're just shouting at each other. And they all go, look over in Europe and how boring their parliaments are and how boring the European Parliament is. It's like, yeah, because it's probably adults sitting down having a conversation with each other. Can you imagine any company that you've ever worked in going somewhere in there, we're all standing around a table shouting at each other. We'd be going, this company is not fit for purpose, right? That's not fit for purpose. These people need to stand up and be professional, and they need to be adults in the way they perform. Now, what's happened with Boris Johnson and Donald Trump is they've both realized you can actually just lie and media will move on. And because they've realized that you can just lie about things and there's no consequences, people don't care, the electorate don't care after a while, the media move on after a while. You know, Dominic Cummings saying he had to test his eye, you know, and as a society, this is our problem. As the electorate, we should be the ones going, no, we don't accept it. But we do, because we treat politics like it's a football club. There are guys, so they're all right if they lie. These guys are, I'm a red team, I'm a green team, I'm a blue team, whatever team you're on. It's our fault that we're not having truthful, sincere adults standing there spending our money. And that's where I think my problem is with this.
I agree with you. It does, that sort of knockabout politics doesn't seem to do anything, does it? You know, yah, boo. And then, you know, forget about it and move on, because all the key decisions are made in cabinet and the parliamentary. You know, if you've got a majority, the parliamentary process doesn't seem to have any check on what a government with a big majority has. We did have, remember in the war, we had a government of national unity, a coalition government. We had a coalition government in 2010 with a dominant partner. But coalition governments you do get a more considered and reasoned decision-making process, because you've always got someone arguing the opposite, or at least, you know, holding someone to account. I think coalition governments aren't a bad idea.
No, they seem to work in other parts of the world sometimes. By the way, if you are a supporter of the blue team and you're listening to this, I also got really annoyed with the red team during the pandemic, who just kept saying, too little, too late, too little, too late. We've got no ideas, but too little, too late. I'm like, oh, for God's sake, we're in a pandemic. At least support them somehow, you know. And again, so you've got both sides. I don't support red or blue. I'm not
a member of a political party either. So, yeah, I don't know why, but I guess, you know, every time I come to the point where I think, well, maybe I should nail my colours to the mast and join a political party, they do something which just completely lets you down. You feel you can't trust them.
Yeah. Yeah, I've met lots of politicians and they're only humans. And I do believe a lot of them get into it for the right reason to begin with. But then they realize they're just involved in this huge power game and they have to be subservient to the whips and all that sort of stuff, which they don't like doing, because sometimes they don't support what they're trying to do. So it's a tough old job being an MP, and especially now the internet's there and they're getting absolute abuse constantly. And I think that's appalling.
Yeah,
as well.
That's fair. That is fair enough. A lot of them do, you know, they work for their constituents.
Yeah.
Selfishly, on not very much money. And most of them do a good job. It seems to me that it's the power hungry ones who are out for their own reputations or selves who seem to cause all the damage.
Yeah. Yeah. So do just finally, because we've run out of time really, do we see any positives? I was just sitting there thinking, how did Finland get to the stage where they're like trying all these wonderful things and they've got these amazing education now and their society seems to be going really in the right direction? Have they ended up like that? What did they do? Why can't we steal their ideas, their principles? Do we know how Finland have done it?
Well, I guess they don't have, you know, delusions of power and grandeur, do they? The Finns have never had an empire. Danes never had an empire. These are countries who have modest ideas about their own place in the world. Whereas, you know, a country like ours, we've got a huge hangover from our empire and colonial interests. And we don't seem to have settled at all in terms of what's our role in the world. And I think if we lowered our ambitions and looked towards perhaps much more modest ambitions, you know, like providing a fair and equal and happy society, then, you know, perhaps we could end up with the sort of happy countries like they have in Scandinavia.
It'll be better for all of us. I think I'm going to leave it there. Otherwise, we'll get into talking about the purple team as well. And then we'll definitely have controversy. Robert, it's fantastic to talk to you as always. Your book, Why You Won't Get Rich and Why You Deserve Better Than This, is out now. Well worth a read. And we didn't get into green economics as well, which he talks a lot about in that book as well, which is important. And in it, there's loads of case studies. Sorry?
I'm saying the Green New Deal, which actually is something that Labour have taken on, actually, it's which I'm really pleased with. They've embraced part of the Green New Deal.
Okay, that's good.
Which is all about sustainability.
What's the next book you're going to read? Not read, sorry, write. What's the next book you're going to write, not read? Oh, you've got a new book out, haven't you?
I've got a book about something completely different. Although it's, you know, some people say it's like Posh Boys, because it's all about Colditz Castle.
Ooh.
And a lot of Posh Boys stuck in a institution in the middle of the country who didn't want to be there. But that's as far as it goes, because this is a book about a British traitor in Colditz who tried to betray, in fact, did betray all the British officers and the tunnels and escape planning they were.
Brilliant. Just tell us what it's called so people can go and buy that
as well. It's called The Traitor of Colditz.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Robert.